Okay, so here we are. What is it, March 4th today?
Yeah.
So I want to, as I usually do, I want to begin by spending some time introducing this chapter and damaged bonds, and we're now reading a chapter called The World Gets Bigger, Chapter 6. And as I usually do, I'm going to take the long way around to approach the chapter and circle back to some of the themes and feelings. But I want to start with a dream image that I had on, I guess it was Saturday morning. And the dream image was a single image of a table with all these little glass jars half filled with water. And there were all these little different plants, like different cuttings and shoots that were rooting. They were growing roots in these little jars of water, a collection of diversity. It was a pleasant image. And so I woke up thinking about that, and I thought, wow, what is this? Is this images of growth, images of diverse capacities that we have, a collection of life, of human diversity? Maybe the little plants represent a bunch of eigenchapters out on the table growing roots. Maybe it's each of us here in the room. Perhaps all of the above. And I thought of the night before, being around a table with another discussion with Duane. So it got me thinking about the quote that I sent out for this week's announcement from Eigen. Therapy provides a relationship that lasts through alternative ways of interpreting itself. It is resistant to destruction by the nourishment it provides, and its destructive aspects do not cancel its nourishing possibilities. The fact that therapy can be interminable brings home the fact that one does not exhaust what life offers and must grant whatever involves one deeply a measure of transcendence, end quote. Wow. So here Eigen is referencing what he sometimes calls the always more of life, the always more of growth and experience. The fact that this precious chance we have at living life, even though it's finite and time limited, is ultimately inexhaustible. Infinity cannot be exhausted by what is finite. And thus, infinity asks something of us. Infinity, by whatever name, deserves our respect at a minimum. And this is one way of paraphrasing another Eigen quote, which is at the beginning of his Psychoanalytic Mystic book, which goes like this. The great lie is that we are going to live forever. The great truth is that we're living forever now. And we're privileged, I think, to break off little bits of life's nourishing possibilities, just as we struggle with the destructive, the painful aspects. And we try to incorporate all of this and make sense of these things in our lives. But we can never arrive at or know the whole enchilada. We can never encompass everything. Just one little crumb, one little slice at a time. Sometimes these little bits coalesce and we get a glimpse, we get a grand view of things, a momentary gestalt some kind of big picture emerges with a gratifying feeling sometimes, you know, like a aha experience or a eureka, only to discover in the next days or weeks that our view or our feeling gets modified as new experiences, new information comes in. Each new day partially modifies and adds to the days that came before. And then I thought, well, does this sort of begin to describe a cycle, maybe a never-ending cycle, similar to analysis and synthesis? Now, last week, Kelly Reams referenced the Greeks, including Socrates and his buddy Plato, who introduced the dialectic as a method of debate and inquiry. That's how it was first used. It was a back-and-forth mode of conversation through which we might arrive at something truthful, or at least begin to perceive error. And as this dialectic notion evolved, it took on slightly different forms. And one of these, it became codified as a kind of a triadic model consisting of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. The basic example is we take something, a thought, a notion, an idea, and then we counter it with another something, perhaps its opposite, antithesis. And through the interaction of these two, some third thing happens. We reach a new synthesis. Something new. A third thing comes out of the combination of the two. Moreover, this new synthesis starts the process all over again. The new synthesis becomes its own thesis, which meets an antithesis, and results in yet another synthesis, and so on. The dance continues. And while this may sound a little linear and boring, let's remember that metaphor itself does something similar, bringing two unlike things together to form a third novel something. And in this way, metaphor creates new realities. It creates the experience of fresh realities, much as we spoke of in these last weeks about symbiosis as potentially creative, potentially synergistic, and able to form new realities from possibilities that are available. So, but isn't this one more way to describe a process that goes on all the time inside of us? Whether we call it reflective awareness, consciousness aware of itself, reflective capacity. And isn't this also related to our imagination, our imaginal capacity? I'm thinking too of our discussion last week about the overlap between perception and imagination. Now, in the early days of psychoanalysis, part of the model was that breaking down and analyzing neurotic conflicts allowed for a restructuring to occur, a new synthesis to emerge. Without analysis of the conflict, the component parts and their meaning, without a rupture in the current constellation that was causing difficulty, there would be no room for something new to grow out of it. So there the sequence was analysis, breakdown, then synthesis. With a slight turn, one might even say regression in the service of furthering ego strength, going backwards to go forwards, or, as I mentioned previously, reaching inward to find or produce or create something of external use or beauty, something true or real. This sequence, too, has a sense of rhythm about it, I should have prefaced today by saying I'm going to go back to the two touchstones, doubleness and rhythm. This sequence, regression, progression, back and forth, is in Eigen's language, he calls it a basic rhythm of breakdown and recovery, injury and repair. Perhaps we get better at dealing with insults and injury the more we practice, the more we practice coming through them. Not that life's pain and sufferings go away, but with a shift of attitude or perspective, an appreciation can grow for what life does present, even in its most difficult shrouds of suffering. In fact, our entire physical universe is said to exhibit a rhythm of expansion and contraction over billions of eons. Galaxies, solar systems, and our own planet, they all have their rhythms. And if we zoom back in from the cosmos to our individual physical bodies, which is its own kind of universe, we find many more biological, nocturnal, circulatory, digestive rhythms. Well, with all of these rhythms going on the macro and micro scales, how can we ignore the possibility of psychological and emotional rhythms, psychic rhythms, rhythms of psyche? And I'm sure each of you could discover or create many new ones to describe, but let me describe a few basic emotional rhythms, how would we label them, like feeling constricted versus feeling expansive, blockage and flow, disruption and continuity, falling apart and coming together, fluidity between conscious and unconscious process, or the lack of fluidity. So many different rhythms. Even a rhythm of different sleep cycles at night, varying levels and qualities of sleep. But what is it that happens when we surrender to sleep and start dreaming? In the first part of our book, the first four chapters, we encountered worst-case scenarios, the terror and dread of unnameable objects and annihilating forces. But if we were lucky, if our early infancy and childhood did not go terribly wrong, we are often refreshed by sleeping and dreaming. In fact, we grow from contact with this unconscious source that is mostly unknown. What shall we do with these unknown inner things that seem to be part of us? Whether we call them the unconscious, or the wise self, or the real self, or the empty self, or self with a capital S, how should we trust it? Can we trust it, such a thing? Does the unknown carry threat and danger? Is it amenable to curiosity? Why should we trust something unknown? Why trust unknowable sources? We certainly don't trust what is unknown when we're about to buy a house or buy a car. We don't trust solicitations or even emails we receive if we don't know their source. Instead, we insist on knowing the source, knowing the insides of the house or the car, or knowing the credibility and trustworthiness of the stranger. How much of a stranger or a taskmaster or an annihilator or supporter is our unconscious to us, for us? Of course, it may be partly all of those things. I speak of it as a something, a thing or a process, but we know whatever it is, it's much more than that. I think the id itself was originally termed the it. In German, I'm not sure, I think it was the it, to convey an impersonal force, an impersonal instinctual force of pressure, part of our nature. Something looking for discharge, for satisfaction, aiming for, to get the equilibrium back. If our unconscious substrate has been too damaged early on, we cannot relax into a state of trust, but instead need to remain vigilant and ward off attacks, often perceiving these threats as coming from outside of us rather than from the inside. Family traumas around all kinds of things, attachment, misattunement, misrecognition, are the least of it. If resting itself was traumatized early on, we may find it difficult to approach resting states or even allow ourselves to surrender to sleep. Early psychoanalysis was focused more on activity. Libido was seen as energetic, instinctual, looking for discharge. Winnicott, on the other hand, was a voice for more passive states, quieter states of being. And perhaps this came from Winnicott growing up in a Wesleyan atmosphere and background. Winnicott felt that quieter resting states deserve study in their own right. And it's, you know, part of his contribution to talk about these states, whether it's, you know, the child in the room with the mother quietly, her quiet presence, supportive presence in the background, and the child doesn't feel intruded upon, but feels the supportive presence and can play or allow imagination to grow, something like that. So I think that Bion and Eigen both feel, and Winnicott, that quiet states are important in their own right. And they're underrepresented in our Western culture. And why? Because affective processing needs quiet time. Quiet time for feelings to be processed. Winnicott depicts a kind of alternation or dual reality of quiet states and excited states, another doubleness. And it is a challenge to be able to give value and to validate different sides of our nature. In a way, Winnicott feels health is more challenging than illness and more painful. That's a surprising idea. Winnicott feels that health is more challenging than illness and more painful because one sustains more tension between capacities in health than in illness. In the latter, ability to sustain tensions between capacities tends to collapse or freeze. Here's a quote from Winnicott. Probably the greatest suffering in the human world is the suffering of a normal or healthy or mature person. Another quote. Tremendous forces are at work within the person when, as in health, they have full vitality. And then Eigen says, as one remains less developed, more collapsed, one endures less pressure and tension from various stimuli because one shuts them out more. Now, this is a controversial, you know, because we tend to think of illness as the greater suffering. I think there's suffering everywhere, but they're just different kinds. So quiet states, perhaps especially feelings and emotions, need quiet time for processing, space to do their thing. You can get a sense of this if you go to a poetry reading or a chamber music concert. And when the reader finishes reading the poem or the music ends, there's this lovely period of silence that I personally find very important. Musicians themselves, you might notice, will often extend this silence after finishing a piece, as if to bask in the listening experience itself, so listening can catch up to itself. And I often find myself wishing that poets would do the same, would extend the silence after reading a poem, because it helps the audience process what they are experiencing without aborting it by moving on to something else. Now, during my Monday evening seminar, we talked in a parallel fashion about who the author of the dream might be. One idea that we arrived at is there is a kind of a double author in dreams. As we found in Jackie's dream in chapter 3, because dream authoring itself seems to have paradoxical qualities involving two-ness or doubleness. On the one hand, dreams, of course, must come from our personal selves, our personal experience. They involve our daily life, the people in it, the personalities we have, those we interact with. But it seems there's also a hidden or an unknown element or intelligence that is not ours alone, or perhaps does not belong to us at all. We don't know what this other thing is, but it may be more impersonal than personal, more not us than us. And so the formulation would become some kind of combination of the two. We could write it something like, I yet not I, as the author of dreams. Who's the author of your dream? I yet not I. Not very satisfying, but I like it. It may not seem satisfying on the face of it, but one gets a sense of the personal combined with impersonal, myself as author, yet something other than me adding to the dream. Whatever this unknown thing is, something we could say greater than the I of our personality that's playing a role in dream life. And in chapter 3, Eigen says at the bottom of 58, as Jackie's dream indicates, it is possible that something in us pays attention to our lives very carefully and creates surprising images and scenes with dumbfounding precision, whether or not we are able to pay attention to it. That's comforting. Whether or not we are able to pay attention to it. That means that dream work is going on, doing its thing, and helping us, whether or not we pay attention to it. That's pretty cool. Well, is Eigen partly asking us to grow capacity for greater attention? Bion certainly was and did. One of Bion's major works is titled Attention and Interpretation, all about attention. So what do we pay attention to? Who or what within us do we trust or not trust? Do we pay attention to? Here I feel we approach a form of faith, which itself is a form of not knowing. It's a patience and a waiting for things to process, to develop, to evolve. But such a style does not fit everyone, nor should it. But I feel, it's challenging to be able to give value and validate all these different sides of our nature. I think Eigen takes patience and waiting to a new level when he writes, quote, In my old age, not knowing what to do has become an art form. I feel more and more liberated from the need to correct or reform or hunt pathology. Life itself may be pathological. It is not doing nothing that is therapeutic, but the way one does nothing. 99. To my ear, this sounds like a credo of psychoanalytic Taoism.
Or
So, we cannot work with everyone who comes to see us, and not everyone can work with us. Sometimes it's uncanny who comes, who stays, who leaves. But for productive work to take place, there needs to be a certain goodness of fit between therapist and patient. And a lot of people coming in today want quick solutions to emotional difficulties, sometimes without wanting to investigate all the onion layers, what they might all be about, the onion layers of emotional difficulty might be about. And let me say emphatically, there is much to be gained from solution-oriented approaches for people who can use them, just as there is much to be gained from all of the dozens and dozens of therapy models and approaches that evolved over the last 100 years or so. Much to be gained with the right person in the right context, with the kind of difficulties that can benefit. And Eigen seems to believe, and I've come to feel, that all these different approaches have something to offer. If they didn't, they wouldn't still exist. They wouldn't stick around for long. They would be gone. But any given model only has utility for those able to benefit from it, not those who don't. And all of these schools, even within psychoanalysis, I don't have to tell the analysts in the room, all these different schools and models might fight for superiority and dominance, but the greater truth seems to be that all of them have something to contribute. Does this mean we need or should master many psychological models? Why not? Many people find this helpful. Add different tools to your toolbox of approaches. All well and good. If one has the temperament for it. Others seem to gravitate to one or two approaches that fit their own personalities, focusing more on their own fit. So it's not a question of starting from the inside and deciding what fits us, or learning all these models, which we all do, from the outside and bringing some in. Of course, we always do both. It's never simply one or the other, outside in or inside out. Those two are always having their own conversation, their own dialectic. So what does all of this have to do with the world getting bigger? That's the title of our chapter, The World Gets Bigger. My sense is that in this chapter we are seeing part of Eigen's philosophy of therapy, as well as something about his own personality and temperament and development. Is this a funny way to frame psychological health or vitality, life getting bigger, larger? Not really. There is discernible growth in each of these two personalities in our chapter. And who among us can judge the quality of such growth? It seems to me that's the job of our clients and patients to decide. We read that Laura sees more, feels more, and works harder than ever. She has even discovered an aliveness she does not know what to do with. Eigen calls hers a crisis of faith, stumbling on a predatory vision of life, touching the questions of what makes being alive worthwhile, what sort of person ought one to be, what sort of being can one say yes to. Also, we see growth in Laura's toughness and resilience, but altered, changed somewhat, as when fighting with her husband Will became more productive, or her newfound compassion for the struggle of others that grew larger. Laura did not want to be subjugating others with her power when she found it, because she knew the pain of being one of the weak ones and did not merely want to turn the tables. Many barriers she experienced as a child did not disappear, and Eigen tries to summarize by saying, quote, "The model was not the dissolution of barriers so much as learning to love the flowers growing within the walls," end quote. How about Milton? Good heavens. By the way, we're not yet done with Milton in the book. He reappears a little more in the next chapter along with a guy named Neil. But Milton, so deeply injured, had by the time he arrived at Eigen's office, he had congealed into this hateful knot, both N-O-T and K-N-O-T. Milton had become, quote, "a critic of the human condition, scenting out deficiencies and lies in everything a person did, especially in himself." And yet, after a time in therapy, Milton began to confess that he started to glimpse specks of goodness buried deep within himself. And for whatever reason, Eigen was able to sense his longing soul, a soul that was longing underneath all that hate, even though it seemed like a soul just filled with hate. It was a soul that longed for the time or the possibility when love was real and before the love-hate connection congealed and soured.